there's a lot of moving parts when it comes to millennials and younger people. And I think that's where there's a misconception, because a lot of advisors will say they're not dealing with distribution strategies or Social Security or Medicare or estate planning or taxes. And I would argue that there are just as many complex planning techniques to be had for young people, whether it's the basics of cash flow and making sure that they have the right savings rate, to buying homes, having children, getting married. All these things cost money. So being able to structure something that is flexible enough to allow them to achieve goals as they pop up.
Welcome to Better Conversations, Better Outcomes, presented by BMO Global Asset Management. I'm Ben Jones.
And I'm Emily Larson. In each episode, we'll explore topics relevant to today's trusted financial advisors, interviewing experts and investigating the world of wealth advising from every angle. We'll also provide you with actionable ideas designed to improve outcomes for advisors and their clients.
To access the resources we discussed in today's show, or just to learn more about our guests, visit bmogam.com/better conversations. Again, that's bmogam.com/better conversations. Thanks for joining us.
Before we get started, one quick request. If you have enjoyed the show and found them of value, please take a moment to leave us a rating or review on iTunes. It would really mean a lot to us.
The views expressed here are those of the participants and not those of BMO Global Asset Management, its affiliates, or subsidiaries.
Millennials are an ever-present topic in the media today. You may have heard that they're digital natives. They'd rather text with someone than call them. They spend their money on travel and avocado toast and want to do work that is purpose-driven.
But there are a lot of misconceptions about millennials, starting with how we use the term. Millennials are a generation that, depending on who you ask, was born between the early 80s and the early 2000s. There's a wide age band in this demographic, so a millennial could have kids and a mortgage and be married, or they could just be starting university.
Today, we're tackling the money mindset of this generation and how advisors can approach this group in order to have better conversations with them when it comes to their financial planning. We've got two guests on today's episode. Each of them have built advisory businesses that cater to millennials.
My name is Eric Roberge, and I am the founder of Beyond Your Hammock. I am in my office in downtown Boston in the Financial District.
Shannon Lee Simmons, New School of Finance, and I'm a certified financial planner. We are recording in Toronto.
I absolutely enjoyed the insights Eric and Shannon both had about how they constructed their practices to purposely serve an underserved market, millennials. In addition, each had really fascinating stories about building their practices when everyone else told them to focus on people with more established wealth. Before we tackle how millennials think about money, how fee-only advising works for them, and how they're different in mindset than baby boomers, or not, I want you to hear from each of our guests about how they got where they are today.
I left the corporate world working for JP Morgan back in 2007 to become a financial advisor independently, and that was right when the market was crashing. And it was a pretty challenging time, but something that I wouldn't trade for the world, because it gave me a lot of experience in a very tough environment, but I didn't have all that many clients, so I could watch and learn without having to deal with the stresses that a lot of advisors had to deal with.
You wanted to focus on working with young professionals and folks that were maybe more in your age group. What really led you to deciding that that's where you wanted to spend your time? Like, why was that such an area of interest to you?
Well, part of it was ever since I started as an advisor, I was told that I had to network. So I would be out at networking events, and naturally at networking events that I was at, I was with people that were my peers. So people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And that led me to have a huge network of people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And I realized that I could connect with them a lot better based on life stage and experience than I could with someone that was about to retire. So rather than fight an uphill battle and try to create relationships where it seemed a bit unnatural, I wanted to be more authentic and just connect with people that I understood. And I knew that I could help those people because I was dealing with my own finances and the challenges that someone in their 30s would have with their money.
I got to imagine you had some people who just thought you were outright crazy wanting to focus on a demographic that, you know, for the most part, really doesn't have any money.
Yes, to say the least, yes. And I remember one conversation very vividly where I was on the phone with an advisor. He was an acquaintance of mine. And I just was still questioning whether I should continue on down this path. I think my business was about 6 months old at the time. And I had an opportunity to get another job as an advisor that was going to be paying me more than I'd ever made in the past. And I was still on the fence. And I asked him, I said, what would you do? And he said, well, you know what? I don't think your business model is something that's going to survive. So I would take the job. And I'm not someone that likes to be told what to do, even though I was asking what to do. And that just had me dig back in and say, you know what? I haven't given my business enough time to actually flourish. So let me buckle down, commit to it, and continue on with my business because I know it can work. I see the opportunity to help people do real things with their money. So I'm going to figure it out. And 4.5 years later, here I am, and it's working really well for me.
I've always been a math nerd and a people person. So finance to me seemed like the perfect marriage of math nerdiness and spreadsheet love and people skills. So I think I was kind of drawn to it that way. But originally when I started cutting my teeth in the investment management world, it was at a boutique investment shop. So it was a small one. And I loved it. It was really great. And that's where I learned the ropes and got all my designations and everything. And then we got bought up by another company. And I was just like, you know what? I really want to go out on my own and try this out. So I left Bay Street, which is our Wall Street, in 2010 and kind of struck out on my own to work with a different demographic that maybe wasn't being serviced by some of the larger financial institutions that typically were focusing on high net worth. And so that's where I kind of started. And everyone was like, there isn't a business model here. And I was determined to find one. So I started New School of Finance, and that's working with basically anyone, but because it's really affordable, fee-only financial planning, it typically, you know, attracts some younger or like families, some people between the ages of like 20 to 50 are that target demographic that are going through, you know, can we afford to have kids? Can we afford to have a bigger house? Can we afford to do this stuff? Like those major kitchen table issues.
Walk me through the genesis of the idea of New School of Finance, because, you know, like you said, I have to imagine there were a lot of people out there saying, Well, this isn't how you make money in the financial services business.
It's actually quite a story. So I did this project. So I left Bay Street and I was just going to peace out of Bay Street for 1 year. That was like my whole plan was just, you know, throw caution to the wind for 1 year and then get right back on the horse. And so
you sound like a millennial.
Totally, right? Yeah, absolutely. Typical, guilty as charged. So I was like, I want to see what's possible. So I did this 1 year project called the Barter Babes Project. What I wanted to do is help young women get excited about financial planning and make it really accessible and really fun. So instead of actually accepting any sort of monetary value, no cash or anything like that, I provided financial planning to 310 women in a year in exchange for a bartered good or service. So no money actually changed hands. So obviously that's not a business model because you can't, you know, pay your rent with lasagna. However, what that showed me was after that year project, I was always planning to go back to my professional life on Bay Street and, you know, continue along the path. But after that year, I was so inspired and excited and in love with working with a different demographic of people that I was like, I need to make this work somehow. And that group of women showed me that there is demand. And so when everyone else was saying there is no demand, I was like, no, there's demand. It's just too expensive. So what we just need to do is find a way to make financial planning affordable and fun and exciting and accessible for people so that they are like, you know what? If I was going to spend hundreds of dollars on therapy, I also could spend a few hundred dollars on financial planning, which will also take the stress out of my life. So maybe there's room for that in my budget after all.
And a little financial therapy.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. I'm also a certified life coach. And I make the joke often that 80% of the time I'm using my coaching skills and 20% is a spreadsheet. So that's the genesis of where it started. And then New School was born from that idea that it is possible. And the whole idea of New School is like, you know, putting the old school model on its head, right? And then starting this new way of thinking about it. So it's been good to me. And it's tougher than I think what a lot of the business models in the financial industry are, but very rewarding. And after now looking back and reflecting, I'm so glad I stuck it out.
Both of our guests built advisory businesses on a fee-only model, which pairs perfectly with the millennial demographic and makes it possible to serve clients that don't have much to offer in the form of AUM fees.
How did your target client kind of influence the way that you built out your business model? I'm maybe most curious about kind of the economic engine of your business model.
So I have a monthly subscription model, and I also have assets under management. But the bulk of my clients come on directly through the monthly subscription. So basically, that's an annual retainer. There's an engagement fee to come on board because there's more work to do up front. But then they pay me monthly, like they pay their gym membership or their cell phone bill. And that allows me to have a consistent revenue stream for my business. And it also aligns more with how I meet with my clients, because I meet with them 3 to 4 times throughout the year to check in, to adjust the plan, to hold them accountable to doing the things they need to do as a young person to take advantage of the time and money that they have now.
We are fee only, and so it's pay for time, right? So a lot of times what I would see in the fee only space would be almost billing like a lawyer, where it's like billable hours at a certain rate. And I tried that in the beginning, and that's important to know as to why this business model works the way that I think it works the way I'm doing it. I noticed that, especially with maybe the demographic I was working with, if it's billed by the hour, I remember sitting there and my client was so aware that we had gone over our time, and I could feel him being like, it's fine, I get it. And he was rushing through the topic, and I was like, why are you rushing? And he was like, well, we've gone over time, and like, I don't want to pay for another hour. And I was like, oh my gosh, that's not good, because yeah. The whole point here is to make you leave feeling confident and excited and empowered, and you rushing through your questions just because you don't want to clock over another hour is not servicing that. So I was like, no, we're not doing an hourly rate. So I packaged things together, and I also spread those packages at those price points based on complexity. So what the business model is okay, so if you have a basic session with us, it's like $250, and this is your session, regardless of whether you go over your quote time or not. It's like, this is the cost, and it's very transparent. It's on the website. There's no surprises. There's no tack on fee later. I'm very much like, no, transparent. So people can come to the website, look at that, decide. And so only when people contact us, they already know what they're going to pay. So it's really great, because that awkward transition, like that quoting period, doesn't happen. Yeah. It's like, and then as it gets more and more complex, so if we're doing household stuff, or if there's variable income and entrepreneur stuff and like corporate stuff, and as it gets more complex, the packages and the types of service shift, and they become a little bit more expensive, right? So our very top line would be a full-blown retirement plan. But we're still thousands cheaper than, like, even if you compare our top service with a typical high net worth fee only financial planner, we're still thousands of dollars cheaper. And so the business model, what works about it is that I think that they're reasonable fees, and I think people can pay them. And I think that, so there's demand created because we have affordable services, right? So I think that that's the first thing. And the second thing, we try to keep really lean on the expenses side. And that's how we can make these really affordable prices work. So we're completely paperless. I try to do things remotely. We do have brick and mortar, so it's not like I'm just completely online. We do have a brick and mortar shop, because people still like to look face to face sometimes with finances. Not everyone, but a lot of my clients still do. But we share a lot of our administrator support staff, share one office, and kind of they rotate through being online or membership-based within our co-working space. So we've tried to be really clever about how we spend money, so that we can, I hate this sounds like a commercial, but pass those savings down to the client. Yeah. But right? Because I have to be very careful and very mindful of how we spend money, because we don't have that sustainable revenue piece. And I think that's the second thing, is that the business model works, but it's scarier than the typical advisor model, because I don't know who's coming in November.
Right, because you're not paying a retainer fee.
Nope.
They're not coming back. They might only come once. You might see this person one time.
You got it.
What I loved about both of their stories is that they found a client type that they wanted to serve, and they built a value proposition and business model to serve those clients. So often we hear about advisors trying to fit a client type into their business model rather than the way that these two approached it. And when it comes to millennials, advisors speak a lot about the position of trying to retain the wealth transfer that might occur from their existing retired clients, rather than helping millennials plan for their own future and tackle their own financial challenges. Now, there are many different ways to work with millennials, but these are two great examples of businesses designed for the clients that they serve. We have talked a lot about marketing over the years on this show, and both of these practices have built marketing programs that specifically appeal to millennials. They both have robust web presences, create digital content on social media platforms, and they work with clients both remotely as well as in person. Now, let's shift gears and jump into specifically the money mindset of this generation. So let's talk about the mindset of millennials.
Yeah.
You're dealing with a lot of unique topics for young professionals that just aren't generally dealt with by the majority of the advising public.
Right.
So walk me through, what are those unique topics that you're covering?
Yeah, it's the financial planning. I call them kitchen table conversations. So it goes beyond just the investment asset mix. It goes beyond just like the portfolio piece. And it's actually what people are talking about at home with their friends, right? Can we actually afford this house? How do we pay back this debt? Can we start a life while we have student debt? Is that a thing? And then it would be like, we're getting married. What is collaborating our finances and combining our finances look like? How do we do that? And what are the ramifications of that? How scary is that? How do we have that open conversation? And then all the way through, you know, purchasing the home, having kids, affording daycare, which is a big deal here. And like, if we have a second kid, can we afford that? And like all of those life events, and someone's passed away and I've inherited some money, and I've inherited some money. So what's our asset mix look like? It's like, I've inherited some money. Do we put some aside for our kids? Do we put some aside? Do we pay off our mortgage? And having that, and because I'm fee only, I have the ability to be like, take a look at the whole holistic picture and give my unbiased opinion. So if I say, no, you should be investing that absolutely for your long-term retirement, there's a, okay. So it's better that like you've seen the whole picture and I'm paying you for your time. So there's no conflict of interest, whether you say like, put in your stock portfolio or paid off the mortgage, right?
So someone goes through this with you and you do the analysis and you say, you know what, geez, time value of money, you got to save something for retirement.
Totally.
Got to put it away.
That happens a lot.
How do they implement? Because you're fee only.
Yeah. And I think that it's a wing and a prayer. And so what we try to do is arm them with a to-do list. Everybody leaves our offices with like an actual numbered to-do list. So like you and I were talking about before with the business plan, manageable goals. So instead of saying you have to save more, we'll say you have to save this much each month to this type of account, right? So it's like, set that up automated from your bills, blah, 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 blah. And then we write it in a to-do list. So a person leaves our office with a plan that they can put on their fridge and check off the to-do list. And if they just do that, all the pieces will go forward. But you're absolutely right to say, it's very possible that someone goes home with this rock solid to-do list, puts it on the fridge, and then ignores it and it never gets done. And then only our follow-up call that we do like after whatever time period it was that we had put in our calendar, like this person should be good until this time. That's when we get that accountability piece, which is like, hey, did you do it? Did it work? And so sometimes it doesn't happen. The one thing I'll tell you though, and I think this is an interesting thing about the being fee only piece, no one's going to pay you for financial advice unless they're dead serious about getting their financial life in order. Because you have to pay out of pocket with like actual money. Yes, you're paying for financial advice from other advisors, but you don't feel it from a cash flow point of view. I find that most of the people that come through our door are already there. They are so ready because somebody who's wishy-washy or like not really wanting to implement a plan is not going to pay for advice. So I do find that the price point and actually having to pay for it is a screening process as well for people who are like really serious about doing it.
That's great. Now, lifestyle, you mentioned a lot of things that are unique to early in one's career and life. But from just a lifestyle mentality perspective,
yeah,
we hear a lot that millennials are different. Now, I'm interested in your thoughts. Is that true?
I don't know.
Or, you know, like what are some of the unique things that you're dealing with from a lifestyle perspective?
So I do have lots of clients who are also Gen X and even boomers. So I can compare the differences in priorities or values, I would say. Okay. So I think that people are just people. Fundamentally, and it doesn't matter if you make $30,000 or $130,000, everyone's worried about money. It doesn't matter if you're 25 or 50, you're probably pretty concerned about it too. Maybe how that shows up in your life is a little bit different. The one thing that I would say besides the typical what's the stereotypical millennial, which is like, you know, they really respond well to digital and social media. But besides that, when I'm actually sitting in the at a table and talking to someone, the one thing that I would say is noticeably different is that I feel like the younger millennial generation is more willing to spend money on experiences than necessarily stuff. That doesn't change the fact that everybody might be overspending or underspending, just like other demographics. It's just what they're spending money on is different. But my job...
Lots of travel
versus like owning some... versus a couch. Like, I think a millennial would rather have a couch that sucks for a lot longer and go on a bunch of trips.
Yeah,
right?
Or a hammock.
Yeah, right? And so I do think that there is a difference in that. But fundamentally... from a financial perspective, the conversation is the same about, can you afford this? It doesn't matter what I'm talking about, really. It's just, how do we make sure that you're financially secure and safe for the long run while still giving you permission to spend some money on things that make you happy? And I have that same conversation with somebody who's 50 and getting ready to retire. And they're like, can we do this? What do we need to do? Our kids are gone or they're leaving soon. And like, you know, our kids are teenagers and their school is paid for. How do we move forward now? What do we do? And the conversation and the tools and the strategies is the exact same as somebody that I would say, hey, you just graduated, you want to pay off your debt? Let's figure out what you can do safely.
So the conversations that I'm having with my clients go well beyond retirement. I think that's one of the biggest things. If you open a conversation with a millennial and say, what do you think about retirement? Their eyes are going to roll back in their head and they're going to walk away. So you really have to find out what they're interested in, asking questions to figure out, are they looking to continue in their career? Are they looking to start a business? Do they want to get married? Are they looking to buy a house? And start to ask a why, and why. And that leads us down a path to a place where I can say, okay, well, this is what you want to do. You want to buy a house in 2 years and you want to have it in Boston. And the reason you want to buy a house is because it's an investment. So you probably want to buy a 3-family. And we can talk about a strategy to have them in 3 years be ready to buy a 3-family home so that they can rent it out and live in it at the same time. So making it personalized to them, but of course, using the overarching financial planning strategies that have been around forever.
I have to imagine you're constantly dealing with the issue of student debt. And so how are you walking millennials and young professionals through the student debt question?
You're right. Student debt is a major planning requirement for someone that's going to help millennials. And I think it's just a matter of understanding the different avenues you could take. Is it federal debt? Is it private debt? What's the difference? Do they want to refinance? Is it possible to refinance? If refinancing is an option, what are the risks of going from federal to private to refinance? Because you can't refinance federal to federal. You know, what kind of protections are you losing out on so that everybody's aware of what they're missing if they go for a better rate? The federal market has a ton of different ways to pay back their loans too. So does it make sense to get into the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program because you're working for a school or a hospital or some other public type position? There's just so many different pieces to it that it's a specialty in itself. And I think if you're not an expert at it, you probably shouldn't dabble in it.
You know, we hear a lot about the millennials kind of wanting this lifestyle and, you know, the gig economy. How do you work through the ideas around gig economy and lifestyle preferences related to millennials that, you know, maybe their parents didn't really have, you know, maybe their parents went to work and had traditional employment situations. So how do you think about that and advise those clients differently?
Well, it's certainly a big career conversation. I think the difference being that millennials are looking for more flexibility at work, maybe working remotely, not necessarily the 9-to-5 job, doing things that they're really committed to and that they can make an impact in versus just looking at it as a job. So you having those conversations to say, all right, well, if you're interested in these things, we always have to check back in with the financial structure to make sure that if your job is going to pay less, that we adjust your expenses and we figure out how you can still save to live this life that you want to live today and tomorrow. It's easier when we can say, well, if you change your job, then you're going to make more money, so we can just do bigger and better planning with that extra income. As long as they're aware that their career decisions have a direct impact on their finances and how that will impact them, I think there's a conversation that we can have that may not be exactly what they want, but something that is a blend between the best financial decision and the best emotional or life decision.
And so before you started your firm, I have to imagine you dealt with a lot of, you know, these, your current clients' parents. And so is this group really different from their parents?
They are focused on different things. I think they grew up in the age of the internet, and technology is second nature to them. So a lot of how they get their news, where they get it from, what they consider important, I think those things are slightly different. But really, when it comes back to it, life is life, and we have different things that happen in life. We're going to get married. We're going to probably buy real estate. We're going to have children. We're going to retire at some point because we can't work forever. So all these conversations from the big picture are the same. It's just a matter of how you go about it, how you communicate with clients, and then eventually how you deliver your financial plan. That is going to vary based on the type and age of client.
Eric made a good point there and touched on something that both of our guests advised. Generational differences in financial priorities might be exaggerated, but how you communicate with millennials may differ greatly from how you communicate with Gen Xers or baby boomers.
I think it's really important to not talk down to millennials. And I'm not even saying that people are doing it intentionally. I think the good thing about advisors who have been in the industry for a long time is that they have a ton of experience and a ton of knowledge, and they have a lot of information, valuable information that they can give millennials. But depending on how they deliver that message, it could really turn people off or help them greatly. So making sure that you're communicating with millennials in a way that they like, meaning what do they need? What are they interested in? What is going to help them get to where they want to go? And then talking to them as if you're a peer and on the same level rather than talking down or from a soapbox. Because I think that's the difference between success and failure when it comes to millennial client relationships.
Do you have to be a millennial to service this group?
Absolutely not.
And if not, how do you communicate effectively?
I think that, no, you do not have to be a millennial to speak to another millennial. That would like be saying that I can't speak to a boomer because I can't understand them, right? That's not the same. What I would say to any advisor, regardless of who your client is try to understand where they're coming from in a big way. And that is intergenerational. It doesn't matter who they are. Try to like see it from their perspective and get curious about who they are. And I think that a lot of times what I hear from my clients who said like, oh, I just sat down with this person and blah, 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 if they are complaining, it's typically that there was like a patronizing tone, or I don't want to say shamey, but maybe like, you know, someone comes to them, they're 28 years old, and maybe they just paid off their debt. They don't really have a lot to show for that. And it's like, well, you don't make enough to qualify to work here. It's like, you don't have enough.
And I'm more important than you.
That feels really bad and makes people feel blue, right? So then they get intimidated and want to talk. There's also one thing that I say, like, we're in the tree of trust whenever somebody comes into my office. And the first thing I say to every single person is, I know it sounds trite, but there are no stupid questions. They don't teach this in school. If you've ever sat there and wondered, I've never really understood what that means, this is the place and time to ask. Ask any question that you want. Giving people that permission to ask questions. And I find that that's something that advisors, especially with a younger demographic, maybe miss that moment. Like, they might say, like, ask questions, but they don't sit and say, you can ask me stupid questions, and I'm not just going to assume you know what I'm talking about. Because what I think happens...
I've made a career out of asking dumb questions.
Dumb questions are the best. Because what happens, and what I'm watching for in a meeting, is body language. When someone starts doing the nod along, right, I know I've lost them.
Yeah.
So I'm very quick to check in and be like, do you understand what I just said? Like, does it make sense? And if they're like, kind of, then I'm like, we're doing it again. And I think that that piece of like understanding when someone's not really paying attention, and not because you're boring, but because they don't understand what you're saying, and giving that space will really go well with a younger demographic and pretty much anyone. But I think that's one of the major complaints that I've heard, is that they felt that people felt stupid after talking to an advisor because they felt like they didn't make enough, have enough, save enough, and that some of the questions they asked, the jargon was so intense that they just kind of rolled with it. when they have no idea what, like, you know, we're going to up your exposure to U.S. equity. Like, that might mean, like, blah, 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 yeah, to somebody. Right. And they just go,
it's Charlie Brown's professor.
You got it. And they're just like, oh, okay. And then they leave the meeting being like, what the heck just happened? And so I think that's where there's an opportunity for people to just, like, don't speak jargon.
Shannon's last point here made me think about Carl Richards from episode 11. He really emphasized the importance of human speak for good client relationships.
Both of our guests were aware of the wealth transfer from generations and talked about why more advisors should seize the opportunity to work with millennials.
It's the next generation, and there's going to be a huge wealth transfer at some point. And so for anyone who's managing book of assets, that's going to be a real thing for your business model at some point, a real boon. And so if you can start now and build the relationship, which again, I think I said this already, is like, that's pretty much what we do. We are relationship people first, any advisor, and then a money manager second, or at least I think it should be that way. So if you can start now and care about the demographic, then when those wealth transfer happens and when those, you know, high earners, not rich yet,
when they get their student debt paid off
and they actually earn money, you're going to be the person that they want to build their life with. And so that's why you should so care about this generation, because it's not lost, not at all.
Do you think that you have to have a practice that's focused solely on millennials, or is there room to have a blend in an advisor's practice?
I think there's a huge place to have a blend. There's no way that I would say that you need to have a millennial-only practice, and it's not realistic for most firms, especially if they were built on baby boomers. There is a transition period, and if you have a big firm, that would be like moving a glacier, right? You can't just snap into millennials like that. So the goal, and I think something that I've told a lot of advisors at conferences when I speak out there, is that if you have an existing firm and you have a baby boomer clientele and they have kids and you're looking for younger advisors to potentially, for succession planning purposes or something else, it's a perfect opportunity for you to bring on a younger advisor, set up a subset of your planning where the younger advisor is focusing on younger clients, that either they're the kids of the clients or new younger clients, and you can teach them how to do financial planning with their peers and then create a succession plan or a legacy plan for your own business. So it can be seamlessly transitioning from older clientele to younger clientele as people age. So it makes a lot of sense. And I think it's a great opportunity for a lot of people out there.
And why do you think advisors that are listening to this show should care about millennials and young professionals?
Well, when you consider the $30 trillion wave of money transitioning hands over the next 30 years, I think you have to pay attention. This is a real thing. The money is going to be moving hands from the greatest generation and the baby boomers down to Generation X and millennials. It's already started to happen. So you really should be prepared ahead of the game rather than trying to play catch up down the road.
We had so many great insights that we could have gone on for two more hours, but you can continue to learn at bmogam.com/better conversations. Check out the show notes for this episode. There you can find links to Beyond Your Hammock and New School Finance. Follow Eric's blog and check out Shannon's new book, Worry-Free Money.
I want to extend a big thank you to Shannon and Eric for making time in their schedules to join this conversation. I hope we can have both of them back at a later date to share more of their insights. This is our second episode in a series of conversations about the money mindsets of different demographics. I want to thank you for listening to the show, and I personally would love to get your feedback. You can email me at betterconversations@bmo.com.
Thanks for listening to Better Conversations, Better Outcomes. This podcast is presented by BMO Global Asset Management. To learn more about what BMO can do for you, visit us at www.bmogam.com/better conversations.
We value listener feedback and would love to hear what you have thought about today's episode. Or if you're willing to share your own experiences or insights related to today's topic, please email us at betterconversations@bmo.com. And of course, the greatest compliment of all is if you tell your friends and coworkers to subscribe to the show. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes, Google Play, the Stitcher app, or your favorite podcast platform. Until next time, I'm Emily Larson.
And I'm Ben Jones. From all of us at BMO Global Asset Management, hoping you have a productive and wonderful week.
This show and resources are supported by a talented team of dedicated professionals at BMO, including Pat Bordak, Gail Gibson, Matt Perry, and Derek Devereaux. The show is edited and produced by Jonah Guile Neufeldt and Annie Fassler of Puddle Creative.
The views expressed here are those of the participants and not those of BMO Global Asset Management, its affiliates, or subsidiaries. This is not intended to serve as a complete analysis of every material fact regarding any company, industry, or security. This presentation may contain forward-looking statements. Investors are cautioned not to place undue reliance on such statements, as actual results could vary. This presentation is for general information purposes only and does not constitute investment advice and is not intended as an endorsement of any specific investment product or service. Individual investors should consult with an investment professional about their personal situation. Past performance is not indicative of future results. BMO Asset Management Corp is the investment advisor to the BMO Fund. BMO Investment Distributors, LLC, is the distributor. Member FINRA, SIPC. BMO Asset Management Corp and BMO Investment Distributors are affiliated companies. Further information can be found at www.bmo.com.